You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Only thing unplugged is Forgotten Seasons.
Welcome, everybody, to Forgotten Seasons, now a part of the Showtime Basketball family. I am Dylan Dreyfus, your host and the creator of Forgotten Seasons. Same drill as always, we're going to be bringing on NBA legends each week to relive one of their best seasons. Today, we got one of my favorite players ever, the man himself, Jamal Crawford, going to be taking us back to 2010 with the Atlanta Hawks. His first season as a true sixth man. He says it completely transformed his career. Be sure to check out Forgotten Seasons on Instagram and Showtime Basketball on all social platforms. We're going to be bringing you guys the fire 5 days a week with Forgotten Seasons, All the Smoke, KG Certified, and What's Burning. So definitely tap in if you have not already. Let's get into this one. Forgotten Seasons with Jamal Crawford on the 2010 Atlanta Hawks begins right now. Jamal Crawford, thank you for joining. Welcome to the Showtime Basketball family, man. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to get into this one for sure.
Yeah, 2010 Hawks. It's going to be a good one. As always, one team, one season. The beginning of an era for you, really. This is your first year as becoming a true sixth man.
Right.
When you think of this team and just think of this period window in your life, what's the feelings and maybe the first thing that comes to mind?
I was going to a winning team. I was going to a team that had been to the playoffs, and I hadn't been. And I was at a point in my career, I think I was in year 9 or 10. I was going into year 10 there. And I hadn't been to the playoffs. And I started to get the label of being known as the good player on bad teams. And I'm like, nah, I've always won, you know, ever since I was a kid, from childhood to middle school to winning high school state championship to college. I didn't play long, but we had a winning record when I was playing. So to shake that label, I'm like, you know what? I know I'm going to go to the playoffs this year. I have a great feeling about it. And also, it was the change in the course of my career of how I was going. So I was pretty much a starter up until that point. And that was the first team that said, you're going to come off the bench. And I'm like, man, I know it's going to be a little bit more unusual for me, but I've been to that point. I'm like, you know, it's all about winning. They've been to the playoffs. I'm willing to do whatever it takes. And that kind of helped change the course of my career.
No doubt. And before we get into that 2010 season, I want to touch on those first 9 years of your career. You mentioned no playoff appearances. You played for Chicago, New York, briefly Golden State. You played for 11 coaches in 9 years. You mentioned it, and I read about you, like everybody from your life just says that you're the ultimate competitor. What is the mental like when you're going through the first 9 years of your career? You're never keeping the same coach from year to year. Maybe those labels are starting to be thrown on you. Like, what does that do to a player?
It can break a player. Or for me, in my case, I try to use it to make a player. I feel like if I can get comfortable being uncomfortable, right? Think about it like this. If you were playing high school basketball and you're a freshman, you're really good. You have this coach, you says you're going to play a lot. You play a lot, you have success. Mm-hmm. Your sophomore year is a different coach that comes in. He's like, well, now I need you to be more of a setup guy. I need you to get guys the ball. Okay, I'll do that. I'll try to master that. Try to buy into what's good for the team. Your junior year, another coach comes like, you know what? I want you to come off the bench. I want you to be a punch off the bench, right? And then after that, you're like, okay, I figured this part out. Now your senior year, the coach is like, well, we're going younger. We're not very good this season. So we need you to be a leader and mentor for the younger guys and just show them the right way to do things. And this is every single year. I've only had the same coach in my 20 years, back-to-back years, twice in 2 years, in 20-year career.
For your whole career?
Whole career. I had Isaiah Thomas more than one season, and I had Doc Rivers. everything. And I've had 20 coaches. So it's just an adjustment. And that's, and to be honest with you, I think that's what I'm most proud of.
No doubt. I mean, I know that you're top 20 in games played. I got to look at the stats and see if do you know, like, have you played, has anybody played for more coaches than you? Because I'd like to look.
That's a great question. I think when I was at like 17, I think myself and Rod Strickland were close, maybe. I think 20, I may have it now. You have to look that up.
So getting back into things, 2008-09, you're in Golden State briefly, and then you get traded to Atlanta in the offseason for Speedy Claxton and AC Law. Yeah. Hawks definitely got a good deal on that one. But like you mentioned, like, the Hawks backcourt is set. They have Mike Bibby and Joe Johnson as the one and two guard.
Right.
You had started pretty much 70% of your games to this point. You were not labeled as a sixth man. You touched on it briefly, but like, how does that initial conversation go down? Who is it with when basically they tell you, like, we're going to need you to come off the bench?
So, interesting point. Rick Sun, who was kind of running the Hawks at the time, lives in Seattle as well, you know. So he came over to my house after the trade went through, and he was like, you know, we have a good team in place. We feel like you can be a third guard. That's how you kind of labeled to me, the third guard. You can back up Mike, you can back up Joe, and you can be that punch off the bench that we need, you know. And to be honest with you, to be very, very honest, at that point, I don't think he believed I would go average 18 points, be the second leading scorer on the team, right? So going back, he was like, you can be that punch, you can be that third guard for us, play big minutes, play meaningful minutes, and people really get a chance to see you in a different light on being on a part of a winning team. And I'm just like, I'm all for it. And I said it and I meant it, and it felt kind of weird. When I knew I was going to be a sixth man and going there, going into like playing pickup, I'm in Seattle, right? So I'm usually one of the first players on the court. I was like, no, I'm going to wait two or three games. You guys get going. Because I wanted to start to see the game when it started, but I wasn't out there. So that's kind of how I tricked myself into trying to at least prepare myself to get ready to be a sixth man. And yeah, that's how the first initial conversation when he came over my house in Seattle, and we talked about it.
I'm sure a lot for you starts on the pickup court, trying out moves.
Yeah,
for sure. Sixth man. So you mentioned, right, you're going to a winning team. The Hawks are coming off back-to-back playoff appearances. They got Joe Johnson, Josh Smith, Al Horford. When you got there and you were talking to reporters about your first experiences, you always commended like the togetherness of the team. Who was the leader in that locker room?
Oh man. I would say Josh Smith was a more vocal leader, right? He was the one, let's go. We got to pick it up. I would say Josh was the loud leader. I would say Al and Marvin and Bibby were kind of the quiet leaders, day-to-day stuff. If you need somebody to talk to, you need a pat on the back, you know, it's going to be all right. Always positive reinforcement. I think Joe led more by example. He didn't talk a lot, but he led more by example. He'll talk once you get him comfortable. Mm-hmm. But up until when I first went there, you saw his work ethic. You saw how he's always a pro's pro, kind of always doing his thing. And they all led in different ways. But I think Josh was probably the more vocal of everybody.
Shout out to Josh Smith, man.
Shout out to Josh Smith for sure. Should have been an all-star too.
Crazy.
Without a doubt. He
I think Bibby too. Him and Bibby are two of the best players that have never made an all-star game.
Absolutely.
So getting more into the roster, I'm going to sort of go down one by one. And I'd love if you could just tell like one phrase, word, or story that comes to mind when I say the player. Let's start out with Joe Johnson, the focal point of the offense on the team. What do you remember about ISO Joe from this time?
How good he was, how complete his game was. Like, obviously, he was the focal point of offense. Obviously, he's averaging 20-plus points. But how unselfish he was. How he had a workman-like attitude. You would never know he was a star the way he carried himself. He was so low maintenance. Sometimes you didn't even know if he was in the room. You know what I mean? So Joe was definitely a star and probably one of the most underrated stars I've ever played with.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough with Joe because he was so consistent and he was so good. I almost think like if he would be able to pair up with another star, like in that time of his life, they could have done a lot of damage, but he was just so consistent. Moving on, Josh Smith at this time, like all around defensive menace. Last 20 years, the only players that have averaged 2.5 blocks and 1.5 steals in a season are him, Ben Wallace, Kirilenko and Anthony Davis. So I don't think people realize, like, you know, he was a special player and ahead of his time.
He absolutely was. Multi-dimensional, can do it all. Great passer, underrated passer, could really see the court. Fiery, no back down in him. He was a great player. Should have made an all-star. At least I was there 2 years. I thought he should have made an all-star both years I was there. He was unbelievable part to the team, unbelievable piece to the team, and someone who didn't get the credit, I felt like, nationally that he deserved, because he was a great all-around player.
No doubt. No doubt. Mike Bibby.
Solid, super solid. Bibby always knew how to keep it light. Like, he was never too serious, even though he was a point guard. He's everything you could imagine from a distance. When I watched him and I was like, man, he's solid. Runs the pick and roll. He was the first one that I played with that threw the pocket pass like that. It was so consistent. I kind of stole that from him. Seeing his 1-2 dribble pull up, seeing how crafty he was, seeing how I never seen him flustered, never seen him rush, never seen him actually really upset. Like, he was just always keeping it light and kept our team together.
I mean, he had been at some massive games before. Remember,
like, right,
Sacramento
playing against the Lakers. Yeah.
Should have went to the finals. Some shit went down there, but shout out to Bibby. I had him on the show, like, one of my first interviews. Like you said, real solid, keeps the light. I could see how that would be valuable just to have out of your point guard. Next guy I want to talk about is actually the coach, Mike Woodson. He gets fired after this season in Atlanta, but every year in his 6 years with the team, the win total went up. They went back down after he got fired. What was playing under Woody like? I mean, you've got a wide variety of people to compare him to, like you were talking about. You got like 20 coaches. So what was playing under Mike Woodson like?
Loved it. I absolutely loved it. I remember the first game I came off the bench, first official game. We're playing the Pacers, and I go 1-for-2. We end up winning the game, but I have 3 points. I take 2 shots the whole game. And so Joe is on me, you know, and he's like, man, you got to shoot more. I need you to score. I need you. But Woodson said, come in my office. And he brought me in his office, right? And he's like, I need you to lead the league in scoring off the bench. He was like, just because you're coming off the bench doesn't mean you're not an important part of the team. I need you to go fill it up. And hearing Joe say it was great. Obviously, that's your best player. He's the one, you know, you're out there with, and you love that confidence. But hearing your coach say it frees you mentally, because he's the one controlling the playing time. You know what I mean? So he's the one saying, nah, go ahead. You got the green light. And when he did that, it empowered me. I averaged 18 the rest of the way that season. Made six man, had some all-star consideration. But it was because of Coach Woodson. He played to my strengths. He didn't, you know, say, you can't do this, I'm going to hold it against you. Similar to Doc Rivers. He was very, very – and he was a scorer. You know, so he understood you would go through a streak where you missed 3, 4, 5 shots in a row. He didn't hold that against you. And I really enjoyed playing for him. He's one of my most underrated, because I talk about Doc, I talk about Isaiah. He's one of my most underrated coaches to ever play for, because he played to matchups. He figured it out, and he was a joy to play for. Funny story about him, I don't think I've ever told. I walked past his office one night, and Will was driving a Rolls Royce at the time. Like, he was doing stuff you didn't see coaches normally do in the NBA. I walk past his office one night. I peek in. It's like 8 people in there. And Cat Williams is standing up on a chair telling a story. And everybody's around like a campfire. Woods at his office is cracking up. I'm like, man, what coach has Cat Williams, a comedian, in here telling this kumbaya story, which is crazy. But, yeah, I've never told that. But, yeah, it was – I love playing for Woody.
That's so important, man. I don't think people realize, like, having a coach that you can maybe relate to, and also that just, like, you know, for a player like you, also a scorer, like – You want to have confidence that if you miss 3 shots, the coach isn't going to be looking to the end of the bench, right?
Right, right. Because you're probably going to miss 4 or 5 if you think that he is going to do that if you miss, right?
Exactly. So, you know, you mentioned, like, we got Cat Williams. What was playing in Atlanta like? It sort of gets the rap, like, maybe not having the most passionate fan base. You've obviously played for a ton of teams. What was your experience just being a player in Atlanta?
I loved it. I loved it because the fans, that they didn't pack it out, but when they did come, they were so supportive, right? And they showed me personally a lot of love, because they were already a good team. And Joe, being the best player, he just got to it. He didn't mess around. He got to it. Bibby was solid. Marvin Williams was solid. Al was solid, of course. Josh was, I think, the closest thing to kind of having like a highlight reel player that they had at the time. And I brought a different wave of that as well. You know what I mean? So Josh is doing his stuff in the air, dunking, blocking shots. Like you said, being a defensive menace, I'm crossing over and shooting threes and not watching them go in and doing types of stuff like that that the fans really took to. So I enjoyed playing. They showed me a lot of love.
You guys had a ton of game winners that season. I don't know if you remember. Yeah. But I know you hit one against Phoenix. I think Josh had like two game winning dunks.
Tip dunks.
Yeah.
And Joe hit some game winners, right?
Always. Right. You know. Yeah. So you guys, that was an exciting team.
It was.
So to sort of zoom out a little bit and look at the scope of the East right now, I think that this is a really interesting season in the league, particularly in the East, because if you remember, this is the year before LeBron goes to Miami. We've got LeBron in Cleveland with Mo Williams and Jameson. We got the Magic who got your guys' number with Dwight and Vince. and we got the Celtics still kicking with, you know, their big three. If you can remember then, like, who did you feel like was the best team in the East that year? Because the Celtics ended up coming out. Orlando got your number and LeBron is there.
Yeah, I felt like the Celtics were. They just won the championship, right? In 08.
Yep. 08.
They just won a championship. So they had it together. So I felt like they were the best. My first year there, if I'm not mistaken, I think they finished first. But when they sucked at All-Stars, they finished first and we were like second or third. Maybe we were third behind Boston, Orlando, and then us, I think.
At the end of the season?
No, at the All-Star break. Because I remember the Celtics got four All-Stars. Mm-hmm. They got Rondo, Ray, Paul, and KG. So I remember they were still really, really good, even though, you know, it was after the championship run. But, I feel like they were the best. I feel like Orlando was really good as well, for sure. Those two were the top. And we probably were right where we were supposed to be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then just at the two guard position, obviously we have D Wade and Kobe at the top there. But you also had guys like yourself, Brandon Roy, Monte Ellis, Ray Allen, Vince. Maybe aside from like Kobe and D Wade, we know how tough they were. Like, who are some of the guys that gave you trouble when you matched up against them?
Monte was really good. Obviously, Brandon Roy is really good. You said those guys. Kevin Martin was still pretty good at the time, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, shout out to Kevin Martin. I love that you said that. I think he was in Houston at this time.
Was he in Houston?
Yeah, he was in Houston.
Okay.
He got traded from Sacramento to Houston.
This is when James Harden started coming up as well.
Yep.
He was still young, but OKC, but he was good. Mm-hmm. Man, you got me put my thinking cap on. Ray Allen, obviously, was still really good. He made an All-Star. And we had our guy, Joe. Joe was really, really good at the time, right? So he had some good guards out there at that time.
Yeah, the two-guard position, it's not the same as it isn't the same as it was. I think there's some guys coming up, but like 2000s, 2010s, like it was
just loaded. It was crazy.
You saw him every night. So then going into the playoffs, you guys finish as the three seed in the East, 53 wins, the number two offense in the league. First round, you get the Milwaukee Bucks led by their flashy, dynamic rookie point
guard. Brandon Jennings, sir.
Mr. Tough Crowd. What do you remember about that series? Because you guys are down 3-2 on the brink of being upset. And right on the other side is their rookie point guard really bringing it every night and almost willing his team to an upset.
Well, before even down 3-2, I remember winning the first two. So we're up 2-0.
Yep.
We lose the next two, right? And so game five, we lose at home. And Joe fouled out. And I believe he fouled out. Well, I knew I was on the court kind of being the main kind of creator, playmaker. And I felt so dejected because I felt like I could have controlled that situation, being up 3-2, go on the road, give ourselves a couple chances to do it. And I didn't play well down the stretch, and we didn't get good shots. And I remember sitting in the locker room for a long time after game five, right? And we're down 2-3. We got to go to Milwaukee where we hadn't won, and the Hawks hadn't won a road playoff game forever. You can look that stat up. I remember that clearly.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. I'm like, damn. And I remember Scoop Jackson. He wrote an article. Because I was kind of up and down that series. And he said, this is what Jamal Crawford was brought here for. I'm going to find that and send that to you. He's like, this is the time. And it challenged me. And I remember game six, I scored 23 or 24, but I let us still win. And Milwaukee thought they were going to win. They had Jerry Stackhouse singing the anthem game six. You had You have Bogan, the all-white suit. They're like, it's over. We're going to end it here. You got Scott Skiles on the other end, who I played for. We go win it. Shocker. They're shocked. And I said, I know we're winning game seven. I think I led game seven with 25. So Scoop wrote an article that really resonated with me. I was like, this is what I was brought here for. And those two games, I played well. We won both.
Yeah, you had 24 game six, 22 in game seven. But that's 22
in game seven.
I mean, people love to talk about maybe the downfalls of the media, but there are those, you know, great reporters like a Scoop Jackson who maybe can light a fire. That's really cool to hear. So you guys sneak by in seven, you avoid the upset, and then you got a Magic team.
It was rolling.
Yes. They had just swept the Bobcats. They took 3 out of 4 against you in the regular season. You played Orlando 8 times, including the playoffs, and lost by double digits 7 of those times. I mean, you got Dwight, Vince, Jameer, our guy, Matt Barnes. What do you remember from going up against that team? And just like, how did you guys have no chance?
If I'm going to be honest, I low-key knew it was over before it even started.
Wow.
Like getting out of Milwaukee was like, ooh, we did that. Mm. Dwight and Orlando at the time were a juggernaut. They were put together well. You had him in the middle. You had shooters all around him. So it was almost a pick your poison type thing. Do we allow Dwight to play straight up and nobody can stop him? Or do we double team every single time? He knows where it's coming from and hope that their shooters have an off week, right? And we chose to double team him that series, and their shooters did not have an off week. And they beat us by an average of 20 plus points, which was like the highest first round margin per game. It was just ridiculous. But I know we're not talking about the following season, but we did play them again the following season, the playoffs. We did play them straight up. We did the opposite. Yep. We did beat them. But yeah, they were a juggernaut in 2009-10. I felt like they had a legit shot to go to the finals and win it, because I felt like they were just so well put together.
Yeah, well, I had Barnes on a few months ago to talk about that season, and he always talks about it. He puts it on Van Gundy, on Stan Van Gundy. He said when they got to the Celtics series, they switched up their entire offense. But I definitely look at like those teams, the Magic team this year and the year before when they had Turkoglu. Those are definitely two of the best teams that didn't get it done and didn't win a championship. All right, so they got your number. They got your number. It might have been over before it started. And then the aftermath of that, like you said, you have one more year in Atlanta, another second round exit. And then, correct me if I'm wrong, but Atlanta didn't have any really cap space. They had committed a ton of money to like Joe Johnson, some of the other guys. And then you sign a 1+1 in Portland and end up declining the player option. It's crazy. Like, you had been in the league so many times, but you said, like, you'd signed so many 1-year deals in the previous years, like you owed it to your family to try and get like a long-term deal. How did that whole free agency situation shake out? Obviously you end up in LA. I read that you were also talking to like the Pacers, the Celtics, the Heat. What was that decision process like?
For me, it was about fit at that time, because the first year in Atlanta was a magical year, right? The year we're talking about. The second year, I was upset going into the season because I knew that they didn't have cap space, and I knew they weren't going to do anything. But more importantly, I knew that the lockout was coming.
Yep.
And everybody was like, this dreadful lockout, it's going to be like football contracts. It's going to be crazy. You want to have a deal in place before this happens. So when it's over with, your deal just continues on, because the contract's going to be totally different. So I'm like, oh my gosh. So I'm putting pressure on Atlanta. Hey, maybe you should move me before this happens. They didn't do it, so I'm upset. So my numbers were down the second year, but my playoffs were actually better. Mm-hmm. It's just, if you go back and look, it was crazy. But my numbers are down. I'm not really into it. I'm like, why don't they just move me? If you want me this bad, just sign me. I don't want this lockout thing is coming. So I get out of Atlanta. I go to Portland. I sign really, really late. I think like a week before the season starts. Maybe less than that. We go to Portland. It's not really a great fit. I play a little bit more point guard than I thought I would. And it wasn't like a point guard like you see now, where you can still go score and do your thing. It was like more of a traditional role that he kind of looked for me, and it didn't really fit at the time. No disrespect to anybody. And then I was like, okay, so people are looking at the end of my Atlanta season, which was a down year. Now they're looking at Portland, it's another down year. I'm like, this next place has to be the perfect fit, or else they're going to start looking like I'm on the B side of what I'm doing. I know I can still do it, right? So I went into that LA Clippers season on a mission. I worked out even more. I was locked in even more. I talked to Chris, Blake, and DJ and Chauncey, those guys early about them wanting me. They were the first team to actually call in that free agency. Mm. They were looking at me and Ray Allen. And so Ray Allen had a meeting scheduled, I believe, on like a Saturday, right? And I got in there on like a Wednesday. And they're like, hey, well, if you commit, we'll cancel on the Ray Allen situation. So I committed, I think, the next day or maybe that night. And then they cancel Ray Allen. Ray Allen goes to Miami after that. So, yeah, I had my...
You were talking to Miami too, though, right?
Yeah, I was talking to Miami, Indiana, the Clippers.
Were you talking to the Celtics?
Yeah, a little bit. Celtics too. Yeah, a little bit.
That's a crazy what if. Maybe you're the one that gets that pass from Bosch.
Right. So maybe I'm in Miami. He's in L.A. That's a crazy like switcheroo. Yeah.
That's a crazy switcheroo. Well, like I talked about at the beginning, like the reason that I was so excited to talk to you about this year is because it's like the complete beginning of an era for you.
Yes,
I mean, totally. In like 10 years, you put together a resume that is probably the best sixth man resume of all time. You and Lou Will are the only players to win it three times. But it's crazy how events unfold, right? Like the first 10 years of your career, you're seeing labels of, is this a winning player? And then the situation flips and the whole arc and storyline of your career changes. When you like put all that into perspective, like what goes through your mind, like realizing, man, like that one decision to really embrace that sixth man role changes the next 10 years of my career.
It changes so many different things, right? And so there's layers to it. It changed the course of my career. It probably allowed me to play longer.
100%.
Right. It viewed me differently because now I'm not looking at it as a scorer that's not valuable to winning teams. Now I'm looking at this piece, almost kind of how Manu was looked at with the Spurs, like as far as being that punch. Right. And so now I'm looking at this. I can be a contributor, a high level contributor on a winning team. Now people in my community, I go to camps all the time. People are like, I didn't want to be a sixth man until I saw you. I'm like, that's crazy because that wasn't even like the scope when I'm looking at it. Right. I'm like, I'm trying to figure out how I can. So I have value in being a good player on a good team and being confident enough in my skills that I can start or come off the bench, whatever. And so all these different layers, who knew that they would play out this way, that I'd be mentioned? Whether I'm the best or not, I don't know. I mean, I would never say that because I have too much respect for people that came before me, the Kevin McHales, Dellis Shrimps, right? Like Ricky Pierce, Microwave, like so many other people that did it before me. But to be in the conversation, right, the last 10 years is like unbelievable. And it's that was not the goal at all. I mean, that's probably the best, like you said, 10-year run besides getting a championship with it, right? Like, so it's crazy.
It's almost like I really do think that you changed the whole stigma of a sixth man. Like maybe before that it was like maybe he's not good enough to come off the bench,
right?
Or to start, excuse me. But now it's like you look at all these teams and they purposely don't start players so they can play in that second unit. Now you have like sixth man lines being dropped in rap songs. Like people really rock with like,
it's crazy. It's crazy.
So just like a few quick hitter questions before we go. I want to quickly ask you about Seattle, man. When do you think that team is coming back? And if they do come back, would you want a role? And if so, what type of role? I feel like you might want to play for them if it comes back soon.
I think it's more realistic now that it comes back than ever before. Like 10 years ago, we're like, oh, in 5 years. We kept saying that, kept hearing it. But getting the hockey team here, I think, was instrumental into setting the tone of how we move forward. Seeing the fan base, seeing the arena change, see different things. I think we definitely get a Sonics team back in the next 5 years, for sure. And I would love to be in the front office putting teams together. I don't think anybody's invested in the city and the community. Seeing players, knowing the NBA landscape, knowing how teams work, being in those locker rooms, seeing different organizations, because not only different coaches, I got a chance to see how different organizations operate and how they move as well and how they connect people and connect their community and connect everybody as one. So I would definitely love to be a higher up in that position if was asked to.
That's dope. Yeah, I know you do so much for the community. You got the crossover program there that gets live, and it's criminal that there's no team in Seattle. Like, think of it, like you list the maybe five cities in the country that are true hotbeds for basketball. Like Seattle is 100% in that conversation.
Yourself,
DeJounte Murray, Michael Porter, Isaiah Thomas. Like the list can go on. So
Zach LaVine, Kevin Porter. Brandon Roy. It's so many. It's crazy.
Yeah. And I think, like, selfishly, I think if they did an expansion, like, can you imagine how crazy that would be in the media? Oh. What players is this team going to keep? This team isn't keeping this player. Like, I think that would just be, I think, like, the NBA might need that. It'd be a frenzy.
It would be a frenzy.
All right, JC. Well, I appreciate you coming on. Anything that you anything you want to plug real quickly? I know you got a ton of, like, charitable endeavors. Anything you want to plug?
Only thing I'm plugging is Forgotten Seasons. I was checking it out, like, just on IG and checking out all this. I'm like, damn, you know, like, the information that you go and how deep you dive, it brings back memories for players, for fans. It sheds a light on teams that definitely should get mentioned a lot more, you know, especially in social media, the way things are now. Things happen fast, everything's going. But Forgotten Seasons is really, really dope. So I was just excited to work with you on this before I even knew exactly that it was you I'd be working with, because I was a fan of Forgotten Seasons. So keep going.
That's what it's all about, man. I mean, like, I truly appreciate that. And you mentioned so many guys in this interview, like Kevin Martin, Monte Ellis.
Yeah.
Like, those guys are dope, and they deserve, you know, especially the younger generation. Like,
for sure.
I think it teaches people, and so many people are just, like, talking these days on Twitter and arguing about basketball, but they don't even know anything about the history. So those words truly mean a lot, and I appreciate that, man.
No doubt, Dylan. Keep going. Forgotten Seasons. Check it out, y'all.
All right, we'll have to bring you back maybe sometime later.
For sure.
Jamal will be a part of Showtime Basketball, so definitely keep your eye out for stuff involving him. Be well, man. Stay safe. I appreciate you.
You as well. Thanks, Dylan. Appreciate you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.